Welcome back to the committee with Senate File 497. And I think, members, we had the opportunity to hear much of the testimony the last time we met last Wednesday, and we didn't have the opportunity to finish this at that time. So, Senator Erickson Ropes, thanks for coming back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad to be here today, and I'm glad again to welcome my Lanesboro friends up here, and especially in such yucky weather. So we do have a bill before you that would create a change in the property tax law that would cover the small inns in Lanesboro. Right now they stand outside of the seasonal rec definition.
Quiet in here. Thank you.
They stand outside the seasonal rec definition. It's creating a hardship for those small inn owners or innkeepers so that they're forced to turn away people who want to stay for just one night, come down, see theater, or bike through the area, stay a night, and leave. They have to stick to the minimum two nights, and they're turning away a lot of business, but the tax disadvantage to them falling outside the current definition is just overwhelming.
And so before we go to the testimony, Senator, do you have an amendment for this bill, Senator Erickson Ropes? I, on my sheet here, it says it's
proposed
to be amended.
Ms. Zoft is telling me I have an amendment.
It's the A1 amendment.
I think you have the A1 amendment, Senator, that we're going to pass out.
Okay, I do have the A1 amendment.
You have that?
Okay.
And, Senator, just first stop for this bill, so this is a delete everything amendment, and is this what you would like us to be working off of? We will adopt it if you want.
Yes, sir.
Senator Moi moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Amendment's adopted. So we're working on the A1 amendment.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two witnesses with me today, and I'll let them introduce themselves and say a few words.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Julie Keeney. I'm the director for the Lanesboro Area Chamber of Commerce, and we appreciate your time on the agenda today. As we were here a week ago, giving testimony to the seasonal recreational tax classification, and today we are here to answer any questions you may have. We have language before you, as last week we had a packet that included a letter of support from our city, Chamber of Commerce, and business owners. As far as action at this point, we are asking that the language be modified to property containing 20 rental units or less, devoted to temporary residential occupancy, located in a township or city of a population 2,500 or less, and located outside the metropolitan area as defined.
Thank you very much. And are you Mr. Armstrong?
No, I am Eric Bungie, owner of the Cottage House Inn, one of the lodging establishments that is affected by this legislation. Yes, the issue is that about 4 years ago, our local assessor made us aware of seasonal recreational property tax law that if we were open 250 days a year or fewer, and the other stipulations that were in the law about numbers of two-night bookings versus one-night bookings, if 60% of your gross revenue occurred within a 90-day period, all these rules that if we could fit our business into, we would qualify as seasonal recreational. So many of us inns, not B&Bs, because B&Bs already have property tax legislation that qualifies them for a tax break, a property tax break. But if our inns in Lanesboro could fit ourselves into this existing legislation, we would qualify for seasonal recreational. So we were doing that. We did that, thereby turning away quite a few of one-night requests. And over the years, we saw that fitting into this seasonal rec classification did save these lodging establishments, our lodging establishment and others in the community, quite a bit of money. However, it was affecting the local economy because we were turning away one-night stays. So it occurred to us that legislation that was written a property tax law that was written seemingly for northern Minnesota did not fit in southeastern Minnesota. So we seek to clarify language in the property tax law that does fit southeastern Minnesota and the way we are used as a tourist destination for not only people from Minnesota but also about a seven-state region. Being as far south and east as we are, we get visitors from Wisconsin, Illinois, Iowa, Nebraska quite consistently coming to our area. And that's why we seek this this clarification. It would certainly help out our assessors, and it also helps out the overall economy.
Thank you, Mr. Lundy. And you, so what, Mr. Lundy, what you're doing is you're trying to balance the tax savings against the potential revenue that if you were open year-round.
No, we can fit in with the 250 days or fewer. We're fine with that.
Okay.
What it comes down to is this ratio of two night or more stays versus one night stays, and the other stipulations, like you must have fishing tackle, you must have canoe rentals, you must have access to recreation, which we do with the trails. But there are lots of stipulations in here that make it, you know, harder and harder for us annually to fit in this classification. If you have an inn of 20 or fewer rooms and you are in a community of 2,500 or fewer, you are seasonal recreational. There's no doubt about it, or you're crazy.
Well, Mr. Lundy, you could Bungie. Be a motel.
What's that?
Mr.
You
Chair,
could be a motel.
Excuse
me. Senator
Chair, I'm sorry. It's Mr. Bungie.
Mr. what?
Bungie with a B.
Bungie, I'm yep. sorry. Mr. Bungie, there are other types of businesses that would meet this, and we want to ensure that we're meeting the definition of seasonal.
Yes.
Perhaps we can look at some other type of recreational definition, but I think we're going to have to look at that a little bit before we move forward with this. Questions, members?
Yeah.
Senator Moore.
Mr. Chair, Senator Erickson-Ropes, how many businesses statewide are we looking at that fit that needs this exception? I mean, it must not only be in southern Minnesota. It must be right throughout the state. Do we have an idea?
Senator Erickson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bois, we have not done a lot of research to see what sort of capture numbers that we're going to be getting with this change in law. We're primarily concerned with Lanesboro, but philosophically, as Mr. Bungie just said, we're pretty certain that in very small towns that have a limited population of tourists coming in during a short period of time, the
250 days of the year.
250 mm-hmm. days that aren't open year-round are in fact seasonal rec, and we're just getting caught in some of the language that has been designed, I think, respectfully, Senator Scoy and Senator Bach, for the northern tier, because you know we don't have boathouses and things like that down in southeastern Minnesota.
And Senator Moore, the revenue estimate says it's unknown, so we it's don't unknown. Know at this point. And Senator Moore,
And then Mr. Chair, Senator Erickson-Ropes, I'm interested in the effective date. There's a January 15th application deadline, and we're extending that to July 1st, 2009. Is that because most of the we're giving the properties that would fall into this exception now the opportunity to go through the reapplication reassessment phase by extending out to July?
Senator Scoy
Senator
and Senator Bois, yes.
Okay.
Other questions, members? Well, Senator Erickson-Ropes, we'll lay Senate file number 497 over for possible inclusion. I'd like to visit with you a little bit about some of the other recreational ideas that might be helpful. I'm not sure that changing the 1 day to 2 day is something the committee is going to be interested in, but we'll have continued discussion about that. Any other questions, members? Anybody else that would like to testify with regard to Senate File 497?
Mr. Chairman, is there, Senator Erickson-Ropes, is there any way to add an additional a reference to theater or trails or some other use for to narrow it up? I mean, I'm afraid that the way it's drafted, there is an awful broad tax reduction statewide. I mean, I can think of a lot of Americans, Super 8, small country motels all over the state, maybe thousands of them, that are going to have a lower property tax that's then shifted on to. I'm just wondering if we can kind of get to the Lanesboro situation by some kind of a unique description of the kind of recreational activity maybe that happens there or something.
Speak to that.
Senator Erickson Robles.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bach, we'd be really happy if we could depend on the expertise of the Property Tax Committee to help us carve out the language that we need. That's why we're specific with the size of the town and the community, but Lanesboro has some pretty unique property tax issues in that it's just a very tiny community. As you know, Senator Bach, you visited, and it's recreated itself as a small arts community, outdoor rec community, but a large number of the homes in Lanesboro are second homes purchased by people outside the area, and so they have all sorts of really unique tax problems in that community.
And Senator Erickson Ropes, maybe you, while your testifiers are up here this morning, would have an opportunity to visit with them on page 2, lines 16 through 18. If you could work in that area, it might be helpful.
Mr. Chair, for additions or?
Yeah, some way to fit yourself into that part of the bill, I would think might be helpful.
See, Mr. Chairman, I'm just thinking if that linkage, the 20% of the annual gross receipts, if there was some way for this group of accommodations to, as a part of your stay, sell amenities that people come to Lanesboro to do, and those were actually marketed through the occupancy community. If there's some way to do that, I'm assuming the things people come there to do aren't free. Much like the resorts do, you know, they market all these things through their resort bill.
Mr. Bungie.
Thank you. The issue there would be we do have businesses, retail businesses in the community that depend on the rental of bikes. They are built around the rental of bikes and canoes, and for the lodging establishments to branch off and add that to their business would be a deterioration, or could be a potential deterioration in their revenue. We are not set up the same way as Northern Minnesota. We are a resort town. We are not, and there are other resort communities along bike trails. I think the Root River Bike Trail is a star in the DNR trail system. If you speak to them, they'll admit it, that it's been a huge success for them. So I would say to add language that might speak to the fact that, you know, the community is along a state trail, a state bike trail might be. But to ask the businesses to add services in order to fit into here could be going against.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not suggesting you add them. I'm suggesting you market them. And if the store down the street rents bikes, you would actually do that transaction as a part of their stay and then just forward that money over that money. So you'd essentially sell a coupon or some feature like that where you wouldn't actually provide the service, but you'd kind of do some marketing for those services and then count and somehow tweak this language to have that count towards some additional revenue other than just the accommodation.
And
I'm just thinking, just off the top of my head.
I think, Senator Erickson Ropes, we need to pull these ideas together, try to tighten this up a little bit. We've got a long agenda today, so we're gonna move on. I didn't see anybody else who wanted to speak on this. So, Senator Erickson Ropes, let's get in contact with everybody here.
Mr. Chair, can I just offer?
Briefly,
It's kind of like, I think this one, you know it when you see it. It really is seasonal recreation, and it may be hard to put into words. But I was thinking, you know, maybe Senator Bach or somebody offered proximity to a state trail, or you know, you could create some uniquenesses that way. I think that would really kind of hone this definition down and hopefully we can do it. Well, these are good people, and they have a good business down there, and they need to survive.
Senator Senjum, Senate Council offered some language that perhaps we can work with, too. So there's some ideas floating around there. Senator Bach.
Well, I'm just thinking, Mr. Chairman, I was just talking to Council. Maybe we could give the city some kind of a special designation. Call the city something that no other city is. Recognize that in law and allow occupancy, the bed and breakfast types, to, because they're in a city of that type, qualify for it. But we have to find some way to narrow it up. It's going to take a little work next couple of days.
Yes. Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Mr. Chair, we'll be happy to take your suggestions, and I'll work with Ms. Zoft in coming up with some language.
Thank you very much, Senator Erickson-Ropes. Chair lays over Senate file number 497 for possible inclusion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Erickson-Ropes, you have Senate file 885.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to have to get that file. Sorry, I didn't bring it to the table with me when I rushed in. So.
Where's Charlie? Jason, get her a copy.
I would think about up on Lake Superior. They get some of that mine stuff. Not as much.
Senator Erickson-Ropes, we'll get you a copy of the bill.
I don't want it.
And Senator Erickson-Ropes, Senate File 885 is a bill dealing with the disabled veterans' property taxes. And we've had a fair amount of discussion about this last year, and we came up with the compromise that we would allow the veteran's spouse to get the property tax reduction for one additional year after the veteran had died. And do you have a copy of the bill now, Senator Erickson-Ropes?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Erickson-Ropes.
Thank you, and I don't see any testifiers here with me or haven't shown up today, so I'll try to wing it here. The idea was just to provide additional privileges and protections for surviving spouses of deceased veterans or of deceased disabled veterans. So we did know that it could continue on for many years if the surviving spouse decided not to sell or just lived in the house. There wasn't a particular end date. So to clarify, Mr. Chair, you're suggesting an additional 1 year?
Well, extension? Mr. Senator Erickson-Ropes, I think currently they get the spouse would receive the current year plus one more year, so 2 years of property tax reduction. And your bill is proposing to extend that until the spouse remarries, which could be any length of time. And you know, we certainly will take a look at this again this year, but we did a lot of work on this provision last year, and so we can see where it goes. Any questions, members? Anything else on this, Senator Erickson-Ropes? Anybody would like to speak in support of or on opposition to?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Bill Efforts. I'm the Assistant Hennepin County Assessor, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. And I guess I'm not really in opposition to the bill other than that the remarrying provision that would be involved here, it would be very difficult for assessors to determine when they got remarried. If possibly, you know, there could be some kind of, if this was the policy we wanted to take, then there could be some kind of provision for a 30-day notification, as in the homesteads. It is ever expanding, this property tax exemption, and we just feel that remarrying provision would be difficult.
A little hard
Thank
to
you.
Manage.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I did talk to the assessor lobbyist about that, and we felt that there could be some kind of trigger mechanism built into the policy of remarriage, or at that time we were talking about even resale, but the resale is taken out. So there could be something that we just internally manage.
Okay. Well, thank you, Senator. Thank you, Senator Erickson Ropes. We will take a look at that if we decide to include this provision in the bill. So chair lays over Senate file 885 for possible inclusion. Thank you very much,
Senator
Erickson Ropes.
Chair.
Senator Koch. Senator Koch, welcome to the Property Tax Division.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members, and thank you for hearing this bill today. Senate File 755 is a the definition of horses, and it actually falls under, it says an ag classification. But there is a provision at the bottom, Subdivision 3, specifically that says this does not apply to property taxes and is not apply to the treatment of land used for raising horses under Chapter 273. So I guess maybe that's why we're being heard today in property taxes. With me today is Dave Dan, who is a constituent of mine from St. Michael, owns a horse operation, and he brought this bill to me.
Mr. Dan.
Morning, Chairman Scoy and members of the Tax Committee. My name is David Dan. I own a farm in Wright County. I raise horses, and what brought this bill about is there's been a lot of discussion. Different groups, animal rights groups, are trying to define horses as pets. Some of the revenue readings have tried to define horses as pets. So this bill is similar to the other existing legislation that exists, whereby a certain class of animal is defined under the Department of Ag, under Chapter 17, as livestock. All this bill does is simply clarify the definition. Horses are currently defined as livestock in several other statutes, but not specifically under the Department of Agriculture. This bill simply puts them under the purview of the Department of Agriculture and specifically defines what horses are used for, how they're raised, and that they are agricultural products and agricultural livestock.
Thank you, Mr. Dayan.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Kurt Zimmerman. I'm the Livestock Development Supervisor for the Department of Agriculture. I work in such areas recently in programs that would deal with drought or flood assistance for livestock operators or grant programs for livestock operations. In the past, we've referred to Section Statute 17 for our definition of who is a livestock operator. And in all honesty, horses have been an area where we've had a hard time from administration of determining whether the equine industry is included. Recently, just last year, we had a livestock investment grant program where we had to include horses in the definition in Statute 17 to specifically tell us that they were part of the program. So it would help in administration of various programs where we're trying to provide some assistance or support to the livestock industry.
Thank you very much. And members and Senator Koch, I've shared with you some language that we've been working on to require the departments to study this issue coming over the summer. Senator Vandeveer has a bill that's up next on the agenda that deals with classification of horses for tax purposes. And so, Senator Koch and members, what I would like to do with all of these horse provisions is to get the language of this study in order. And Senator Koch, I believe you do have a bill, the Senate file escapes me right now, that did have the request for the Department of Agriculture. And Mr. Zimmerman, have you been working on that language also?
We do have. We've been working very closely with the horse industry, but we would be willing to consider working on a working group for all definitions that would incorporate more than this bill. But we have been, we are willing to chair and be part of that group.
Okay, and so I think what we should do, Senator Koch, and we'll have questions from members here, but what my thought is on this is that we should get the Department of Revenue and the Department of Ag to take a look at this. There's a lot of interactions, and we need to make sure that we're not having some unintended consequences. Any questions, members, where we're going with regard to this issue? Senator Kolk, do you have anything you'd like to add to this?
No, and Mr. Chair, we have spoken about the proposed amendment, and I do have a bill. I think it's 1836. I'm not 100% certain. I've got the wording in front of me. I just would point out that in the proposed language that you had given me, it only references the Commissioner of Revenue, and I think it would be a mistake to do that. I think the Department of Ag needs to be a player in that discussion, obviously. And so I guess some sort of hybrid, perhaps, of my bill and this proposed language might at least move the ball down the court. And this also does delay some implementation for classification changes for a year, which would be helpful, I think, for a lot of horse farmers. So.
Mr. Chairman, there's also an issue. Actually, the DNR came to see me about this, and they're real nervous as it relates to hunting regulations around livestock. So it'll have, if you classify a horse as livestock, it's going to have an implication of what kind of hunting opportunities are available around livestock, because there's some restrictions in current law. So we'll have to. I mean, I think that's a part of it too.
Thanks, Senator Buck. Mr. Damian,
Dayon. If I could respond to Senator Bach, horses are already considered livestock, and as such, any existing hunting situations don't change. I mean, they're already livestock under several statutes, and so there would be no change to any existing stuff because they are already livestock under several statutes.
Mr. Chairman, DNR Senator came Bach. To me and expressed some concern that they have to. There's hunting regulations that issue. It's not my issue, I mean, but they made a point of coming to me about it. So,
Senator Kolk, let's you and I and the committee continue to work on this. I think Tuesday we're going to put the property tax article together, and I'd like to include this provision in that article at that time.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks to all the members. And we can bring in the DNR as well. I'd be willing to work with them, Senator Bach, and resolve that issue. So,
anybody else want to? Anything they need to say on this issue, Department? You okay? Okay. Question. Thank you very much. Chair lays over Senate File 755 for possible inclusion in the property tax article. Thank you, Senator Cole. We need to hang on to that. And Senator Vanderveer. Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair, do you use sign-up sheets for your committee, or?
Gee, I don't know.
Okay.
Nope.
Mr. Chair, this morning I'm here before you on Senate File 1671, and that's for a personal property tax exemption for a power generation plant. And my testifiers that I have today are Blake Wheatley from LS Power Development, and then I have Chisago County Commissioner George McMahon and Lent Township Supervisor Gene Olson. And if I could have Mr. Wheatley address the project, he's with LS Power who's developing it.
Mr. Wheatley.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Again, my name is Blake Wheatley. I'm a general manager with LS Power Development. LS Power is an independent power project development company. We focus on safe, reliable, and competitive energy projects, and we have a very successful history of commercial execution. Since our inception in 1990, we have over 20,000 megawatts of development, construction, and operations experience. And one of our earlier projects was the Cottage Grove, Minnesota project that was developed in the 94-95 timeframe. Even with the recession that we're currently experiencing, we remain very active in power generation, both renewable as well as fossil, and transmission development as well. Our functional expertise runs the full gamut from project development, licensing, environmental, regulatory and transmission, power marketing, project finance, as well as construction and operations. Our development philosophy is to work very closely with the needs of our customers, including investor-owned utilities, municipals, REAs. We focus on building and operating facilities that are safe and protective of the environment. And we pride ourselves in our ability to work closely with communities. Senator Alcine has introduced Bill SF 1671, which would exempt from property taxes the personal property of our proposed natural gas-fired generating facility in Chisago County. Minnesota is unique in the upper Midwest in that its laws apply property taxes to utility personal property while not taxing the personal property of other industry. This disadvantages an independent power project in Minnesota from a similar project in adjacent states such as Wisconsin or Iowa. And every independent power project developed since 1994, starting with our Cottage Grove facility, has obtained such an exemption. I believe that we have made available to the committee a fact sheet that describes the project that we're proposing, and I would be happy to answer any questions that you may have about the project.
Thank you, Mr. Wheatley. Mr. McMahon and Mr. Olson, you guys have anything you'd like to add? Mr. McMahon?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is George McMahon, County Commissioner from Chisago County. I also have one of my colleagues with me, Commissioner Rick Green. This morning we're here to support the bill and support our township, Lynn Township. The project is located in Lynn Township in our county. Our county unemployment rate right now is going on 13%, and this project would, for the next 2 years, support several hundred construction jobs, and we're here to support that. Also, one of the issues that comes up when you with power plants such as this is the use of water, and we have come up with a unique plan where we're going to be using the wastewater from our wastewater treatment plant in Chisago County to circulate through the power plant, which will lessen the use of water from wells in the county. Again, our job today is to support our township in their effort to bring this project to their township. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. And Mr. Olson?
I am Gene Olson, chairperson of Lent Township. Lucky to be the host of maybe this adventure. We're excited about it. We're also well aware of what Mr. Wheatley said, that we are a border county, and we don't want to see this slip over to Wisconsin. So we're supporting it all the way. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Wheatley, besides the construction jobs, how many ongoing jobs are associated with this project?
We would expect an operating staff of 20 to 25 permanent positions once construction is complete.
Okay, thank you. And Mr. Wheatley, I'm reading here its expected operation is 10% of the time. Where's the electricity coming from the rest of the time?
Well, we're proposing both peaking units as well as intermediate units. The peaking units would be simple cycle units, simple cycle combustion turbine units. The intermediate units would be combined cycle units. The peaking units would operate up to approximately 10% of the time, whereas the intermediate units could operate up to approximately 50% of the time. This facility would connect to the electric power grid at the adjacent Northern States Power Substation, the Chisago County Substation, which is on an adjacent parcel. And when we're not providing electricity to the grid, customers of utilities connected to the grid would simply be getting electricity from other providers, nuclear energy, wind energy, and coal-fired power. Okay.
Thank you. And Commissioner McMahon, you know, we've had a number of, or at least some jurisdictions in Chicago County down there looking for some aid increases. And if we continue to give these exemptions for property taxes, and we've got a significant number of parcels in your jurisdiction that are on green acres and other preferential property tax treatment, doesn't that kind of continue to shift the tax burden onto those jurisdictions that are down here asking for aid increases?
Mr. Chairman, but for this legislation that is before us today, this project would not go forward. The legislation, as I understand it, that we're asking for today is needed for the company to make the decision, are we going to continue the project in our county? And there's several other issues that will be talked about during the process, but this legislation is important to keep the project going.
Mr. Wheatley.
If I could respond to that as well, what we're seeking here is to have this project treated like other industrial facilities in the state of Minnesota, other industries that are not considered utility property would not have their personal property tax would not have their personal property taxed, whereas utility property in Minnesota is somewhat singled out. So all we're asking is for our essentially manufacturing facility of electricity be treated like other manufacturing facilities in Minnesota.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. A couple of my questions were already answered. I was going to ask about the water. That sounds really interesting. I'm curious to know more about the water. I'm very supportive of these peaking plants. They play a essential role in the strategy of dealing with, you know, the baseload ability to respond to, you know, the peak hours as well as evening out the peaks and valleys of the intermittent renewable energy resources. So they're great, but you know they raise a lot of questions because, especially if they're not sitting next to a river or something, they're going to be drawing a lot of water from the ground, from the water table. And so this idea of using the nearby municipal sources is really interesting. We've had this conversation about you know, personal property tax on new electrical generation facilities, particularly the renewables, but others as well. And then, of course, we have the utility communities in talking about kind of rolling that back a little bit for the pollution control equipment. And I remember Chairman Bach kind of raising the question, you know, we kind of give these out on a one-at-a-time basis, and, you know, it might be time to have an overarching policy discussion about personal property tax exemption for new electrical. I think we even do it for baseload now, too. We just kind of, as new generation is built, we give these individual one-at-a-time personal property tax exemptions. So has that become the de facto policy of the state? Okay. Is it a good idea? Is it a bad idea? At some point, we maybe need to just reflect.
Well, I'll let Senator Bach respond to that, Senator Dibble, and I'll see where he goes.
Senator Dibble, I'm interested in a new policy, too, that they should pay property taxes. And I'm wondering what would the property tax burden on the plant be if it was taxed, if it was built and it was taxed? I mean, how much savings are we talking about, and you'll hear by providing the exemption?
Well, I want to
Mr. Wheatley.
Excuse me if I could.
Mr. Wheatley.
What we're proposing is to exempt our facility from personal property taxes. And we will be certainly paying the real taxes on the real estate just like any other industry in Minnesota. We anticipate that the property taxes that we would pay would be approximately $915,000if the exemption is granted. If the exemption is not granted, we calculate a number something close to 10 times that amount. And if we had to pay property taxes on the personal property that we would bring into the facility, it would make the facility uneconomic. We just would not be able to go forward.
And Mr. Wheatley, you know, we could also should or probably will consider, you know, putting you guys in with the state general business tax also, so you could be treated the same as the other businesses in the state. But, you know, I actually carried one of these bills when I was a House member, and I remember a lot of the discussion. And, you know, they talk about moving the facility that I was working on to North Dakota, but The problem is you need transmission lines, and you got to have the peaking plants where the people are, because that's where the usage is. And so, you know, there's more to this than just picking this project up and moving it into Wisconsin. Now, I understand Wisconsin might be closer than North Dakota was in my situation, but these are more complicated than just kind of moving them around. And I think Senator Bach is right. We need to really sit down and take a look at what we're doing with this.
Well, Senator Mr. Chairman, Bach, my larger concern, and I expressed it last year, is we build a peaking plant, and I remember the one in Elk River last year, Great River Energy was in here and said it's going to run 10% of the time. They're going to spend hundreds of millions of dollars of capital on a plant that's going to run 10% of the time. That is a horrible return on your investment. There's no efficiency in that, to pour in huge amounts of capital for something that you get very little utilization out of. I think it's a poor policy. But, and the other problem is, as we raise demand for natural gas through power generation, for example, as we raise that demand, we put more stress on our natural gas supply. And every homeowner that's on the gas line feels it, and industry really feels it, because any kind of manufacturing, industrial production, are anytime you add value, something coming from the ground, it takes a lot of energy. Those are energy-intensive businesses. And as we raise the price of natural gas, it has a huge impact on jobs and on our competitiveness in this global economy. And I remember when the COO was U.S. Steel was here last year, and natural gas historically has been, I don't know what the unit of measurement is, but $2 to $2.50 for that unit of measurement. And as it relates to the mines, it spiked up over $11, and I don't know where it's at today, somewhere mid-range there. But a dollar increase in that natural gas costs U.S. Steel $100 million a year. $1. So it is not insignificant to put additional stress on natural gas as it relates to our industrial production in this country. We have to be very careful with what we do to the cost of energy, because there's big economic impacts. You know, and around here we'll put some more money into LIHEAP and we'll try help the low-income homeowners. But what are we going to do for the business community, the energy-intensive business communities, that are we just going to send all them jobs out of here because we can't be competitive in the world market anymore because we've driven the price of energy up through additional demand in areas where I just think there are other alternatives than gas peakers. And if there isn't, we need to figure out what they are. So to the extent we incent them so that we develop more and more of them, invest huge amounts of capital with low rates of utilization, and then at the same time put more stress on the natural gas demand, I just think as a matter of state policy, we're headed down a road here that we're going to have some serious impacts on our state. So I do think, Senator Dibble, it is time to revisit this whole idea, and I just don't accept the premise that because we exempted the last 23, we should do this one. Maybe it's time to take a hard look at what's been going on since 1994. And, you know, we're hemorrhaging manufacturing jobs in this state. Maybe we need to figure out why. And if our energy cost is part of that reason, I think we need to figure out how we get our arms around that. And I'm really worried that this whole notion that we're going to generate more and more electricity with natural gas is a contributing factor to some of our economic problems in some of our sectors. And that's kind of repetitive from what I said last year. But.
And Senator Olsen, you kind of stepped into a larger ongoing discussion that the Tax Committee is having. But I
have a gift of that.
Yes. Commissioner, did you have something you wanted to add? I saw you had your hand up.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think Blake would be better. I was going to answer, but I think he has the better
Mr. Wheatley
statement.
If I could, I want to address a couple of points that Senator Bach raised. First, the low utilization. peaking facilities like this with a capacity factor of up to 10% and the intermediate facilities with a capacity factor of up to 50%. They're designed to fit very well with the other electric generating facilities that are on the grid, and in particular, they serve to complement the wind generation that we see coming up in the future. As you're aware, wind does not unfortunately blow all the time. There is an incredible amount of wind being developed in southwest Minnesota and in the Dakotas, but when the wind stops blowing, the electricity stops flowing. In a facility like this, which is relatively inexpensive compared to other fossil-fired generation, can stand at the ready to essentially complement the wind generation that's being developed. Second, I think you raised the question of whether we can simply move a project from Minnesota to Wisconsin. That certainly is a very good point. We have sited this facility adjacent to one of the largest electric substations in the state of Minnesota, and we have received interconnection results from the Midwest ISO that indicate that we can connect this without any new upgrades whatsoever. So it does fit very well in Chisago County. However, we have a backup site that is in Wisconsin that's adjacent to a similar substation that we have not pushed forward as we have waited for to see if we can get this project developed. But it has similar characteristics in that it can also be developed with minimal interconnection upgrades. So we are certainly aware that you can't just move a project from one state to another, but we have identified a very feasible backup site.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Wheaton, what's the cost of this construction project? We heard a couple hundred jobs. What's it going to cost to build?
We're looking at a minimum investment of approximately $300
million. $300
million. The capital cost from a capital intensity standpoint, that is very, very low compared to a similar coal-fired facility or a nuclear-fired facility, and it's substantially lower than most renewable energy facilities. And yet, it still provides that backup, if you will, for when the wind does not blow, and it helps to kind of address the need for filling in the baseload needs, at least with regard to the intermediate facilities that may be raised by the lack of new coal-fired generation in Minnesota. One other item, in order to minimize the impacts on natural gas to other customers within the state, we have included the capability for fuel oil backup during periods of time when natural gas might not be available, we would have the ability to operate on fuel oil to help keep homes and businesses getting gas when they need it.
Oh, thank you. Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, maybe the department can help me. If the plant costs $300 million to build, what would it be assessed at? I mean, we got the new rules now that we assess power plants on. Does anybody know?
Maybe.
Because, Mr. Chairman, I'm just looking. If it costs $300 million to build, even at a 2% class rate, which we're lower than that, would be a $6 million property tax bill at 2%.
Well, Senator Bach, let's lay this over. And Senator Olsen, as I said, you're part of our ongoing discussion with what we're going to do with regard to personal property taxes and utilities. I think we'll get some more information from the department as to what the property tax impact is. Did you have anything else you'd like to add, Senator Olsen?
Mr. Chair, yes, and that's. With any kind of an issue like this, there's always the not in my backyard issue going on. And basically, I'm bringing this bill forward so that we have a yes, that they can continue on with the further development, which will be the Public Utilities Commission, DNR, and Pollution Control Agency, and all of those, or no, the project would not go ahead. So I'm supportive of the project. I do have some concerns with the water, but I feel that I can work with LS Power and we can work with them to minimize water usage in the plant. This is the starting point. If we can get this tax exemption, the project can move ahead. If it doesn't, then it's done. So,
well, Senator Olsen, I don't think the Senate did any of these last year. And, you know, in the end, I think there was one that did happen. So you might want to wait till the end of session to figure out what your final decision is. But we'll continue to work on this, but it's a kind of a thorny issue. So any other questions? Thank you very much, Senator Olsen. Chair lays over 1671 for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Vandeveer.
You know, Mr. Chairman,
Senator,
I'm just talking to the council here, and those of you that are in the power industry, we are really struggling to figure out why utilities don't want to pay property taxes. We just can't figure it out. I mean, they go to the PUC, they get cost recovery on every dime. It's not as though the utility pays the taxes. You know, I just can't get my arms around why they don't think they should have to pay, and all the rest of us, including the business community, have to carry the load for them because they don't want to pay.
Well, and Senator Bach, Senator Olsen mentioned it, the not in my backyard syndrome. If they were willing to contribute to their community, they might have less resistance to some of the stuff that they're trying to do. I don't get it. Different subject, Senator Vandeveer. Senator Vandeveer. Senate File 775.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 775 is intended to address the way land is valued and taxed as it relates to horses. And there is some confusion, apparently, and the intent of the bill was to provide clarification in statute for what I don't know what appears to be a misunderstanding on the part of the assessors as to who, how these properties are taxed and whether they qualify as agricultural. So I have a witness here who can explain the problem more in depth.
Mr. Ramberg?
I'm Mr. Ramberg.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dan Ramberg. I own a boarding facility in Washington County, City of Hugo. What sponsored or spurred this thing to become a Senate file of 775 is that there was representatives from the Washington County that went around and deliberately made a point to tell different facilities in within the county that from here on they will be taxed on a commercial base. They did not come to my place, so I can't say it for sure, but I have to take the word of these people, and hearsay has that it was for true. It was very true. So I could not, and I'm sure any other facility, boarding facility, could not stand a commercial classification. That would absolutely shut us down. We're not a very profitable business. We do it more for the love of the activity. It does a great deal for the youth of the areas. The kids that board and show horses out of my place, they're just a great bunch of kids. Keeps them busy, all kinds of things. In contrast, Washington County, to show you how they think, they closed down 4-H. Now, isn't that a wonderful thing to do? So anyhow, we're the last dog standing to help these kids out, get through their adolescence and enjoy life. And it's not just kids. There's 50% of adults that also have horses at my place, so that I don't take an overlap and be redundant. I'm going to ask Allison Eklund if she can further answer questions for the committee.
Thank you very much. Ms. State your name for the
thank
record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Allison Eklund. I'm an attorney from the Twin Cities area. I live in Roseville. I work with Mr. Ramberg, and I also represent equine business interests statewide. I have clients who are here before the Senate Agricultural Committee who I was representing and who I continue to represent in their tax appeal pending in Sherburne County, which is how this issue originally came to Mr. Ramberg's attention and to my attention. With your permission, I would like to give you copies of the correspondence that was received from the Sherburne County Tax Assessor that has been since affirmed and upheld by the Department of Revenue Property Tax Division.
Page will come. Ms. Eklund.
The documents that I have provided to you include correspondence from the Sherburne County Assessor and correspondence from the Department of Revenue Property Tax Division to Sherburne County, and also most recently a copy of a letter dated, I believe, March 25th from Mr. Golden Folkman, the Director of Property Tax Division of Department of Revenue, affirming the department's interpretation of Minnesota Statutes 273 Section 13, Subdivision 23, relating to agricultural classification, and it's subsection I-3 that relates to horse boarding facilities. I could spend quite a bit of time going through the letter from Mr. Folkman, and I will not do that. Suffice to say that there are numerous legal errors in that letter regarding classification under current law, and we believe that this demonstrates the real problem, which although we're going to have a court address those legal misinterpretations on a trial scheduled for April 23rd, but in the meantime, it is imperative that this issue be clarified for assessors and for the Department of Revenue as soon as possible, because right now, assessors who have been doing this correctly for the last 18 years that Mr. Ramberg's horse boarding classification statute that he passed in 1990, it has been going along just fine until we had one assessor classify a property the wrong way and then have it upheld repeatedly by the head of the Property Tax Division. This creates a stew of problems statewide because assessors are saying, look, we thought we were doing it correctly, and now the Department of Revenue is saying that we're not. Now we have to go and reclassify all of these horse boarding facilities as commercial industrial. And it all comes down to the two problems that I raised before the Agricultural Committee. One of them is the cutting down pasture and having to bale it and sell it to a third party and then buy it back again before feeding it to the horses, which doesn't make any sense at all. And the second problem is that all of a sudden the presence of a riding instructor or a horse trainer, which is an essential part of a safe boarding stable operation, was turning an otherwise agricultural horse boarding stable into a commercial industrial facility. That, again, is an absurdity that creates an imminent hazard on horse boarding stables. If you are going to turn them into commercial industrial classification for having a horse trainer, they're not going to have anybody around to teach these kids how to handle their horses. And that is a situation that cannot wait. We really would encourage the committee to make sure that this bill is not lumped with anything else that is unrelated, such as Mr. Dayan's Senate Bill 755. He's talking about the agricultural Chapter 17 of Minnesota statutes, has nothing to do with Mr. Ramberg's bill, and I would encourage the committee to consider this completely separate, addressing an issue of property tax classification that needs to be clarified as soon as possible.
Thank you, Ms. Eklund. And members, I heard this testimony in ag, and so I made sure that we got it over here because this really is a tax issue. And there's a number of issues going on here with regard to horses and horse boarding and agriculture and food and fiber versus recreation. You know, if you think back to all the discussion that we had with Green Acres, I think obviously we view pasture as a productive farmland, but in the statute, horse boarding must be done in conjunction with raising and cultivating agriculture products. Is that a pasture or not? I think obviously if a farm has, you know, 5 to 7 acres per animal and they're pasturing it and the pasture is able to sustain the horse, well, yeah, you probably would, but if it's somebody's backyard, well, it probably wouldn't. And size is not contemplated in what we're talking about here, so we've got some issues there. I think that we need to bring into this discussion the use of the horse. I mean, Senator Dill talks about how he uses his horses to work in his animals. Obviously, that's a different use and more ag-related than somebody who's riding for recreation. Mm-hmm. And you know, we had the Senator Koch in front of us, and I've given Senator Vanderveer a copy of a draft of some language that the committee is contemplating. And what I would like to think we might head toward is to have the department spend the interim reviewing this study. But in conjunction to that, to address the issue that's going on with the change in the classification, give the Commissioner of Revenue the ability, if the landowner wants to appeal to him, to have the department look at whether the classification change should take place this year in order to give us 1 year to kind of study this and understand this and know where we're going to go. And, you know, at first blush, I thought this was a pretty straightforward issue and that we could just say, oh, well, yeah, that's egg production and therefore it should be. But it is much more involved. And now Senator Bach has brought up the issue of DNR and horses and livestock. And I think we need to kind of understand that. Senator Vanderveer, I don't know if you've had a chance to review that language, but what I'm hoping will happen here is that we'll have some study language that will work with the Department of Ag and the Department of Revenue and the Senate authors of the three bills that are out in front of us. And so, Senator Vanderveer, I see you're reviewing that. There are a couple of other people who want to speak to this issue, Mr. Hagen and Mr. Efforts.
Mr. Chair.
Yes,
Senator Orman. Can we see the study language that you're proposing? Is it in our packet? Because I didn't see it.
Senator Ortman, and that is, I just got a kind of a draft of it. I do have a few extra copies here that, if you want, we'll get to you, yes.
Oh, Mr. Chair,
Senator Ortman.
I don't serve on the Agriculture Committee, but we have plenty of agriculture out in Carver County, and there are facilities that would benefit from this type of clarification. It seems a little odd to me that if you also have bees, then you get this classification, if you have bees on the property, or if you have a little fruit garden or vegetable garden or you have something else, you qualify. But if you don't, it's not sufficient on its own. And so there, when she says that it's a stew of problems, I kind of liked the rhetoric there. I think I might use that. But the stew of problems, I agree with that. I think it creates absurd results, and I don't think we want that. I'm not sure we want to wait a whole year to address absurd results that we know we've got codified. So I don't know. I'd like to see the study language, and I definitely support the department studying, but I wonder if maybe we shouldn't clarify in the meantime, and maybe the department can at least explain to me why we shouldn't clarify this right now.
And Senator Ortman, I think we're getting copies of the study language. I won't go there. Mr. Hagen.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, my name is John Hagen. I'm Assistant Director of the Property Tax Division. And as I listen to the testimony, it highlights a lot of the issues we're dealing with. I want to be very clear on nothing changed in the classification laws with respect to the horses. If assessors are making changes, they are probably correcting things or maybe there's some misunderstandings. One thing that Ms. Eklund in particular talked about that rang a bell with me was how nobody really understands horses. Nobody, the lay people who aren't involved in it, really understand when a boarding or breeding should be agricultural and when it's recreational. I believe there's a spectrum of horses ranging from the big commercial arenas with the shows and the rodeos and all the various things that go with that. On the one hand, that in my mind is not agricultural. On the other side, we want to be very careful not to make everybody who has one or two horses in the backyard agricultural, which would likely give them green acres in the same case. I think there is some agricultural activity in the middle where people are breeding horses or boarding horses that is something we need to identify. But I don't really think, from what I've read and looking at some of the court cases, that we're really know enough about horses to make that decision, which is why I would certainly applaud and ask for a one-year study period where we can understand it better, understand what involves horses and when it should be agricultural, when it should be commercial, when it should be residential. So,
and Mr. Hagen, would you explain to the committee the discussion we had with regard to the appeal process and the Commissioner of Revenue?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. What we would like to propose is a way to try to catch the ones that are falling, the farms, the horse property that's being reclassed, is if they would like to appeal that decision instead of just, if they believe the assessor is correct, that obviously would be no reason for appeal. But so that we can try to get the properties that are being reclassed, if they could maybe appeal to us, and we, with a mind towards having a study that would better identify when horses are agricultural and when they're not, we could make an opinion on it and try to, for a one-year period, maybe try to slow things down and take some of the pressure off so that these properties in all probability would not change classification unless they clearly were inappropriately classified.
Yes, and we would do that without predetermining the outcome of the study group's decision.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. Very good point.
Thank you, Mr. Hagen. Mr. Efforts.
Yes, Bill Efforts. I'm the Assistant Hennepin County Assessor, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. And I don't want to be too redundant here. I think it's all been stated, but we just say that this would be a dramatic shift for assessors to include horses against current policy, other than with the use in conjunction language. And we just feel right now that it would be too overly inclusive, and we'd have a trouble discerning what would be recreation versus commercial. And I just wanted to express those concerns, and thank you very much. And we fully support further study of this issue. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Vandiver, have you had a chance to review the study language?
Yes, I have, and I think it works. I mean, I think it's appropriate. I think it's a good idea because if, in fact, as they're saying, the bill would mean everyone with one horse and no other limitation. That's not our intent, so I think studying it and getting more information on more ideas on how to deal with it is a good idea, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Vandiver. Senator Artman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Vandiver, you're very diplomatic about this, but I'm still struggling why this is such a dramatic shift. I think if we're talking about horse boarding and horse breeding for commercial activities, the property will generate income. It will be an income generating activity, clearly the distinction between recreational and commercial use. So I'm being way too simplistic, but I don't understand, and so maybe one of the two of you could explain to me. I know Senator Vandiver, again, very diplomatic, but I would like to understand why this is so difficult.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Senator Artman, we have worked with a great deal with income requirements and looking at Schedule Fs and things like that to determine agricultural classification with respect to green acres. And it's amazing how, if there is a property tax benefit and an income, things will move around. There was one county some years ago that had a particular bull. We called it the Traveling Bull of Wright County, who was sold from one farmer to the next, and I don't believe the bull ever actually left the yard, but each farmer would identify, or each property owner would identify income, and then when they sold it, they would just keep moving around. So everybody showed an income, and then they would sell it at or about the same price. So there was a push on it, but that would satisfy the green acres requirement. Our concern is that an expansion, if there was a benefit, a very big property tax benefit, and there would be, particularly if they could get on green acres, that unless we could identify any unintended consequences and try to stop that from happening. You'd have people that might legitimately be renting a boarding for a neighbor's horse in conjunction with others, and that would be agricultural perhaps.
And Senator Ortman, the other thing that we're going to try to at some point bring into this study is the IRS hobby farm and income requirements that are out there. You know, we need to try to make sure that we're conforming with those at the same time. They have requirements that you have to have so many years of profit and that, you know, that sort of requirement also. So this is, you know, it's more involved. As I said, when I first heard this in Ag Committee, I thought this was this pretty simple little issue that we would take care of, but it's not. And so I'm hopeful that we'll get an education for all of us as we go through the year. Senator Vandiver.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Ortman, I had thought that the description on 328 didn't need any clarification, so that tells you how good an attorney I am, because it says it includes what qualifies, and it just says the commercial boarding of horses if the boarding is done in conjunction with raising or cultivating agricultural products, as defined in the previous clause. So to me, it didn't need any clarification, but apparently it does.
Any other question, members? Anybody else that would like to speak with regard to the horse issue? Seeing none, the chair will lay over Senate File 775 for possible inclusion. Thank you very much, Senator Vandiver. Senator Dahl here. Senator Dahl, welcome to the division and Senate File 1912.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Senate File 1912 would provide that commercial buildings over 50 years old would qualify for a reduced rate of the state general levy, assuming that the property is located in a city with a population less than 50,000 outside the metropolitan area. The property contains a structure originally built over 50 years ago, and the property is located in a downtown area that has been designated by the city council, or at least 50% of the parcels contain structures that were originally constructed prior to 1950. I guess, you know, as small towns deal with the economic crisis, and especially older downtowns, obviously it's the property tax rate is driving many of those businesses out of business. So I have with me Ross Currier. He's the director of the Northfield Downtown Development Corporation. Also in the audience is Joe Grundhofer, owner of the Rubenstein, and former Mayor Keith Covey of Northfield. So I'll turn it over to Mr. Currier.
Thank you, Senator Dahl. Mr. Currier.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Ross Currier, and I'm the executive director of Northfield Downtown Development Corporation, a nonprofit organization dedicated to downtown vitality in Northfield, Minnesota. We have been working on this issue for at least 4 years, first with former Senator Tom Neville and more recently with Senator Kevin Dahl. Since 2000, commercial property taxes have increased by double-digit percentages every year. That's right. Most building owners have seen their taxes increase by over 200% in the past 7 years. During the same period of time, rental rates have remained flat or, in many cases, have even declined. As a result, each year there are fewer dollars available for basic maintenance, much less money for building improvements. Rent rates in downtown Northfield are at modest levels. Most are in the $6 to $8 per square foot range. With the mortgage costs at between $3 and $3.50 per square foot, common area utilities at 70 cents per square foot, and insurance at 50 cents per square foot, there's only about $2.25 per square foot left for all other building costs. Since the year 2000, the average property tax cost has gone from $1.50 per square foot to $2.50 per square foot. In fact, I have seen the year-to-year operating expenses on about a half dozen buildings in downtown Northfield. Indeed, they have gone from producing positive cash flow to a point where the owners are now having to draw down savings to keep their buildings operating. We know that we are not alone. In December of 2007, we hosted a regional summit on the issue and found that other communities in southeast Minnesota are having similar experiences. But it's not just about the economics of old buildings. These older commercial districts are important to Minnesota. These districts are the most visible indicators of community pride, can be a key asset in the efforts to recruit and retain residents and businesses, serve as a focal point or gathering place for our citizens, and symbolize our community's heritage. The NEDC supports the policy change before you now. We believe that this action will help assure that older commercial districts can continue to contribute to the health and vitality of our communities, support the retention and recruitment of residents and businesses, serve as incubators for the creation of new businesses, and help maintain the quality of life in small towns and cities throughout the state of Minnesota. Again, I thank you for your time and attention to this important matter.
Thank you, and thank you, Senator Dahl. We're certainly been aware of the ongoing struggle to preserve these historic buildings in downtowns, but, you know, there's also, there's lots of issues surrounding it. Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Senator Dahl, I had a similar proposal that simply exempted the first $150,000 of value for the state levy for all commercial industrial, especially the small structures. It's targeted more at the small structures, and I continue to think that's maybe a good idea in this period. It was pointed out to me, however, that creates a significant shift. This was a statewide. It creates a significant shift to other sorts of property. So I hadn't quite yet gotten my head around how to deal with that. And I know the House is bringing that provision in. Don't know if we're going to be bringing it in. I doubt that we are. But we'll have more discussion about it in conference committee. But as I look at your proposal, as you exclude the metropolitan area, I'm looking at the revenue analysis detail, and I see that you have the similar shift from the lower tier to the upper tier of $5.7 million. But what really got my attention was the shift from the non-metro to the metro area is $14.4 million, which I have to admit doesn't make me crazy and wild about your proposal. Are there any thoughts about how we respond to and address that? So we got difficulty managing these small properties, the economic supply along Lake Street and, our commercial corridors and our business nodes and the like. The challenges are very similar in my neck of the woods, and so the idea of taking on additional burden to respond to your issue doesn't make me super happy.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. Mr. Chair, I knew that might be an issue, and I appreciate the opportunity to have the discussion, and it may be a fact that we are working on the issue, trying to figure out ways. We certainly know that we don't want metro versus non-metro, and we hope that going forward we can find some way to bring more equity. I don't know if you wanted to address the question at all about the metro versus non-metro.
Mr. Currier.
Thank you. I'm really not an expert on this issue. However, I do know stories from building owners over the last 7 years, and my understanding is some years ago there seemed to be an inequity between the metro area and outstate, and so assessors in greater Minnesota were encouraged, I guess, to bring it more in line, and I think probably the first 3 or 4 years of the last 7 or 8 years, we're bringing it in line, but the last few years have just made it so that the buildings are no longer economically feasible to operate.
Thank you, and Senator Dahl, I think we'd have to work a little bit with that issue, of course. And the other thing I'm wondering about, and I hadn't really thought about this till I was sitting here, but it's 50 years. I mean, I'm older than that. I don't feel historic. Is that a reasonable time frame to be addressing this, the architecture of the 60s? Good, Mr. Currier?
Mr. Chair, I'm 1 year away from that. But anyway, I'll let Mr. Currier address.
I just turned 50 a couple weeks ago, and I need a new roof and some tuck pointing, and my lower structure is a little shaky, too. When we first started talking about this, we were looking at 30 years because that's typically when the major building expenses start coming up, like a new roof, retuck pointing. It moved from 30 years to 50 years, and frankly, 1959, as I well know, is 50 years. So we're really, when we started talking about this, it was really focusing on having enough money available to take care of these older buildings. And historic preservation is good, but maintaining buildings that are simply getting to the point where they are starting to have significant capital expenditures required is our focus.
Thank you. Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dahl, why would this proposal not also apply in Norwood Young America or Cologne or City of Chaska? Why are the metro areas excluded?
Well, I think Senator Dahl.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
I thought Senator Dibble just kind of went this route.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. I stepped out for 2 minutes.
Okay.
I apologize for that.
Senator Dahl.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ortman, and again, we've kind of, we know that's a concern, and I think that it's a concern. It seems to be more of a concern. It's like the metro area. We are the next wave, and it seems like that our assessments are being based on a lot of what the metro area is being assessed at. And so I think it was a try to bring some more equity, and we just feel that we're on that outer ring, and we're trying to bring some balance. That is a concern, definitely.
Thank you. Any other, Senator Dibble?
Well, thanks. I just wanted to say I'm sympathetic to what you're trying to achieve. It's part of, an ongoing effort to address and keep intact central business districts. That's a good thing. I think consideration does, though, need to be made for, we have, what are effectively small towns in the urban core, called neighborhoods. We have, the commercial nodes, we have the commercial corridors and the like. And I'd be, much, much more sympathetic if we weren't just simply picking up, the balance, the $14.4 million in the metro area. So, I think we can continue to have this conversation as we assemble our bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Anyone else want to speak on Senate File 1912? Mr. Efforts?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senators. My name is Bill Efforts. I'm the Assistant County Assessor for Hennepin County, and I'm here on behalf of Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. And MAO supports the classification system that is understandable, and we support the efforts for consolidating those classes. Administratively, on the surface, this would create a new class of properties. But more importantly, we noticed that there would be certainly a shifting going on that's been certainly discussed. We also think that it would create inequities with those properties, the newer property versus the old properties, generally the same size, competing for the same tenant or the in the same market. So we would think that that would cause some inequities for us and certainly for the property owners as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything else, Senator Dahl?
Well, Mr. Chair and members, we appreciate the hearing. We've actually haven't had a hearing in several years. And the fact that you are willing to discuss this in the future and the fact that we brought the problem to your attention and know that towns like Northfield are really struggling to maintain their main streets economically, even though it's a great place to visit, it's a tough place to make a profit. And so we appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today.
Well, Senator Dahl, I think Senator Dibble and Senator Ortman, we're concerned about downtowns and viability, and we'll see if there's some creative new idea, way to address that. But thank you for bringing this forward. Chair lays Senate File 1912 over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Senator Dibble.
Get my quote from yesterday.
Chair, I bring Senate File 1348, which is an effort to establish a property tax deferral mechanism, an opportunity for seasonal and recreational property that's used for non-commercial purposes. So would, Mr. Chair, what this, the idea for this bill it would be to allow half of the property taxes for those properties that are for C1 that have been owned by the property owner for 15 years to be to request a deferral of up to half or half of their property taxes that they owe. The bill provides for quite a bit of detail on what kinds of properties would be eligible. Like I said, the 15 years, no existing federal or state tax liens, no more than 60% of the estimated market value can be exceeded in unpaid debts or mortgages or other liens, special assessments, et cetera, and no mortgages or other liens that would exceed the amount of the debt limitation. The property owner would have to annually certify its their continuing eligibility for the program. The mechanism, how this would occur, is the state would effectively loan the half of the taxes that would otherwise be collected by the locals to the local jurisdictions and then file a lien against the property. Then, of course, the property is the program for these properties would be terminated upon sale or transfer, death, notice of intent to exit, if the property tax class changes, those sorts of things. It's anticipated, Mr. Chair and members, that it's similar to the senior deferral program that we're aware of that has very little participation for all the reasons that we're familiar with. Folks don't like to put liens on properties that they may be passing on to the heirs. A lot of these folks don't like debt, that sort of thing. But so it's anticipated that, according to the fiscal note that I saw, and I have another fiscal note that I didn't see until this morning, so I haven't had a chance to assess or evaluate it. But the kind of the earlier fiscal note that I saw anticipates 40 years in there, 40 participants in the early years growing to 120 and ultimately to about 200 folks. Nevertheless, folks with the Minnesota Seasonal and Recreational Property Owners Group feel like this might be something that we could do for some folks who feel like property taxes are killing them. They can perhaps avoid selling the property, hang on to it for the enjoyment of themselves and their extended families so long as they own the property. The fiscal note that I did see this morning has something to do with the Department of Revenue feeling like they need to hire a whole new person to develop this program and do computer programming and the like. I think they're looking at about $100,000 in expense or so. So I don't know if we can figure out a way to deal with that through the application fees and the like. I just haven't had a chance to figure that out because, like I said, it showed up in front of my eyes just today. We have Jeff Forrester, who's the executive director of MSRPO, and he can share some thoughts with you about this idea as well.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Forrester.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jeff Forrester, and I'm executive director of Minnesota Seasonal Recreational Property Owners. As Senator Dibble sort of talked about, I get a lot of correspondence from our members, and there's one slice of the membership, older, usually retired. They're seeing their dividend income, their retirements shrinking, and the property taxes are still going up. And I'm getting these kind of, these emails, we're afraid we're going to lose our place. Help. Can you help? I think that this, applies to just kind of a small slice of the society of the population, but for that small slice, this would be a big deal, I think. I have a couple of the emails. Judy and I are in the rock in a hard place. We have lost more than half our well-planned retirement savings and seemingly are going to be forced to lose our beloved lake home. I hope we can squeeze by the next tax statement. And then it appears that we are on the way out, and this is the place we have as a family. My parents and my family and earlier my kids and grandkids did enjoy, while considered by some a luxury, the place has been a family gathering place that has brought many of us together through many adversities through the years. Can we save it? Let us hope so. P.S. At age 72, I am even substitute teaching to make ends meet, Larry and Judy Smith. And I have a number of these types of emails, and this is sort of where this, you know, where this bill is directed, is that these types of people and their situation specifically.
Thank you, Mr. Forrester. And questions, members? Senator Bach. Oh,
Mr. Chairman, I just asked counsel, and she's looking, but Senator Dibble, would this be applicable to people who are not residents of the state, people that just maybe from Illinois that own a cabin here? Are we doing something specifically for Minnesota residents who have a cabin, who have a homestead and a cabin?
Yeah, that's a good question, Mr. Chair. I think the answer would be...
Senator Dibble.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the answer is, I'd have to look at the detail of the bill, but I think it would be available to anyone.
Yes.
At this point, I think the criteria of eligibility does not specify Minnesota residents.
Mr. Chair, I don't think that you could extend that benefit to Minnesota residents and not make it applicable to other residents. It would be a residency requirement that would be illegal.
Well, and Senator Dibble, you know, in the property tax area, we've always struggled when we have properties that are similar or the same treated differently based on ownership. I mean, it's a problem to deal with that. And here we're setting up a mechanism where, you know, you'd have neighbors, one who had owned their cabin for 12 years and one who'd owned it for 16 years, getting different tax treatment. And, you know, that's always... That causes problems, and so we'd have to kind of look at what we're doing there. Did you have Senator Dibble's response?
Yeah, that's an excellent point, and you know, certainly willing to work on that, or you know, eliminate it. I don't think that makes or breaks the bill. I think the idea that we were trying to introduce was, you know, recognizing folks who have made a long-term commitment to ownership of that property and want to continue owning it, you know, for the foreseeable future, want to be able to do that. I think that was the idea in that language. Certainly not the do-or-die provision of the bill, though.
Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, the idea that, to Senator Ortman's point, the idea that never caught hold, and I remember it was floating around over in the House for a while, would be to give some preference to Minnesota residents that have a cabin. The idea of allowing a second homestead, and I think it was Representative Milbert had it at the time, that allowed a Minnesota resident to actually have two homesteads, the second one, you know, maybe taxed at a different rate. But it never seemed to, the cabin owner lobby never seemed to pick up on the idea. But it would kind of narrow down the tax preference to people that are residents of Minnesota that, you know, kind of narrows, I think, the scope of the cost. But Mr. Forrester, I'd like you guys to think about that some. If there is some kind of, you know, we've got a relative homestead provision in law, but it seems like when cabin taxes are going to continue going up, and I would like to, we can't do anything about market values are what they are. And but there ought to be a way we can try to provide some kind of special treatment to Minnesota residents who also have a cabin to try to preserve that. And whether it's through some kind of an additional homesteading process, I just think we need to think about that because I don't think this issue is going to go away. And I you know, this program probably will be utilized even less than the senior deferral program, I think, because I think most cabin owners want to pass the cabin on to the kids or the grandkids or something, and I don't think they want to pass it on with a lien attached to it. So I'm not sure we'd even get 200 people to enroll in this, but I do think we need to figure out what our long-term strategy is to make sure that, you know, just average income Minnesotans can still have an opportunity to have a cabin because it's getting more and more difficult.
Well, and Senator Bach, as you know, your committee has in the past couple of years tried to reduce property taxes on these folks by taking them out of the state business tax. You know, and that bill has been heard this year also. So
we, I think we heard it last week.
Yeah. So, you know, there's other things we're trying to work on also. Any other questions, members? Anybody in the audience that would like to speak with regard to Senate File 1348? Senator Dibble, anything else you want to add?
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. Good conversation. Appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. Chair lays over 1348 for possible inclusion. Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, Senate file, can we take 1102 first?
1102, Senator Bach.
Mr. Chairman, there is an issue that one of my counties brought to me, and it's the issue of where the county has some nuisance property, and they just have a property owner that's unwilling to clean it up. And so what the proposal does is would allow the county to do, I believe it's an assessment, I have to look at it, allow the county to do an assessment on the property to clean up the nuisance and then essentially assess the property owner for the cost of that. And I do believe cities have that authority under current law, but counties do not. And then the second piece of it I think is a little more controversial, and I'm not even sure I like the idea. This bill came over from the House, but the second piece is just the same thing, to allow the county to do an assessment to correct environmental, wetland, or land use violations. That's broader. I don't believe we have that authority with cities, but I have with me a constituent from Lake County and county official that would like to speak maybe to their the reason they brought the bill forward.
Mr. Conroy?
Yes, thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Russ Conroy. I'm a county attorney in Lake County. And I have one other attorney in my office. It's a small office in a small population in the county. And I was reminded of that last night, and it has something to do with this bill. I was walking through the nursing home, which is connected to the local hospital, and there was a resident there that I recognized. His name is Werner Falk. And Werner was the sexton of the Two Harbors Cemetery. He was a grave digger. And he had 20 acres outside of Two Harbors for years. And he used that 20 acres to collect stuff, junk. He called it scrap. Everybody else said it was junk, and it was right on the road, Waldo Road, leaving Two Harbors. And everybody complained about it. And Werner tried to clean that up. He just didn't have the wherewithal to do it. So we gave him some leeway. We went into court. We said, Werner, we're going to get an injunction. We're going to have to clean it up, have you clean it up. He said, I know. And he agreed that it needed to be cleaned up. He just couldn't do it. So we got the injunction after a lengthy delay where we offered it to him. And then we gave him some more time to clean it up after we got the injunction, and he still couldn't clean up. And finally we had to have contractors come out, and he was there the day the contractors came out to clean out all this junk, and he was crying because this was his stuff that was leaving. But the community viewed it as junk. They called it Disneyland. And it got cleaned up, and Werner sold it. Werner made money. And we got a judgment lien on it after we cleaned it up for the $8,000 it cost us to clean it up. When they had the closing on the property, we got our check for $8,000. That was unbelievably easy. It took 2 years to get it done, but that doesn't happen every day. I don't know if you've ever tried to enforce a judgment lien, but they're not that easy. We don't have that opportunity to put that bill on the taxes for that property, which we cleaned up. And Werner even saw our solid waste guy who got together with the contractors. He got the
project going. He saw him a couple months later on the street, and he thanked him for doing that because it enabled him to do what he couldn't do on his own. Now, most of the property owners, as Senator Bach has said, aren't necessarily interested in us coming out and helping them, especially at first. So we get called to do a lot of things, like clean up junkyards, do environmental cleanups, remediate wetlands that have been trashed, and enforce our land use ordinances. We can't go in and put that on the tax bill. We have to go in and get a judgment and attach to the property and hope that at some point it's going to sell and that we will be able to collect at that point. But we don't have that authority. As Senator Bach said, the cities under 429 have that authority right now to clean up a nuisance. They can abate the nuisance. We don't have that. We're asking that that be applied to counties as well because we're dealing with that. And the issue of the environmental, wetland, and land use, if you think about it, if you know environmental law, it started out in the nuisance area. That's where environmental law comes from. And now it's its own separate field of law. But we can't take, so I don't know that we can take it. And talking with other county attorney's offices, I don't do this on a full-time basis, this type of collections enforcement. I'm a criminal prosecutor, so I have to talk to other offices, and I've talked to other offices and the Minnesota County Attorney's Office, and there's kind of a discussion back and forth on what exactly authority do we have in the area of nuisance and environmental to assess. Most people don't think that we can. And we're just asking to be able to put the bill of the cleanup, the remediation, whatever, on the tax rolls for the property, a special assessment for environmental, for wetlands. We have a case right now, 10 acres of wetlands. It's going to be a huge bill. And we have a property owner who's not interested in cooperating with us, and I'm just scared to look at that, what it's going to cost, because we can't afford to go in and clean that up and then clean up the next junkyard or next wetland. We can't afford to do that. We need to be able to get that, recoup those finances back. So that's what we're asking for. And the thing about wetlands, it's interesting. If you look at Section 8 of 429, where it talks about what things the cities can do, it says they can drain swamps. And that's, if you think about that, when's the last time you heard something referred to as a swamp? You know, the bogs, fens, wetlands is what we talk about now. But swamps, and when's the last time the city drained a swamp? You know, it's something that a few years ago we thought was a good thing, but I think times have changed. But why is that in there, the drain of swamps? Well, my point is that's a wetland. We've already got authority to do things in wetlands. What about fixing the wetlands? Give us that authority to specially assess when we have to go in and do those types of things. That's all I have.
Thank you. Senator Bach, I tend to agree with you with regard to the nuisance issues because in our area, counties are the ones that do the land use ordinances primarily. The environmental cleanup, I think, would require quite a bit more study, and very likely other committees would have some interest in it besides the tax committee. So I don't know what you want to do with that. Questions, members? Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bach, just a concern about the imposition of special assessments, not a very popular tool among residents. And we have some problems with that process as it is. Residents don't think that they get sufficient notice. They don't understand. They miss their opportunity to be heard. And I think rather than expanding that authority for additional uses, at this point in a bill, it needs to have much bigger, broader discussion among the cities and their residents before the cities have this new power tool. Just my thought.
Well, Mr. Johnson, Senator Urban, one of my House member worked with officials in the county on this, and the first I saw it was when they sent the bill over, and I do think that line 1.19 is a pretty big expansion of assessment power, but giving them the power under 1.18 that cities already have to remediate the situation that Mr. Conroe explained seems I guess I'd be surprised if we find any pushback in that.
Well, and Senator Bach, I think, you know, we can deal with this when we're putting the article together, but I think 1.19 is going to be a concern. Any other questions, members? Anybody else want to speak with regard to Senate File 1102?
You know, it would be nice, Mr. Senator Chairman, if everybody, you know, the guy with the junk car lot, you see him out in the countryside, and I drove by one on Sunday. It's a terrible eyesore on Highway 53. And I know the individual that owns it, and he's just collected all kinds of old campers and old junk that, you know, you could take a part off, you know, for some use someday. And I know that individual that owns that, and there's no way he has the resources to clean that up if he wanted to, no matter how bad he wanted to. He doesn't. He's just collected it over a, you know, a 40-year lifetime, and it just can't happen. And this kind of legislation would be a vehicle where a property owner might think it's a good idea to be able to pay that cost over time on the property taxes, and you know, the cost would maybe when he sold the property could get cleaned up and then sold, and it increases the, you know, the market value of the property. I don't think it's always a negative thing for the property owner either. Creates a vehicle. The way banks are acting these days, I can't imagine they'd give anybody a loan to do something like this.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Bach, on that though, we had quite a bit of discussion when we talked about condemnation, because one person's business might be somebody else's nuisance. And I think that we need to be really cautious about that, because people make livings at some of these businesses that to some might be an eyesore. And we definitely talked about whether a city should be able to look at the tire shop that's been there for 50 years and decide that's a nuisance and we're going to condemn that property, even though it might be the source of a living for somebody who operates that facility. And so I think sometimes a good idea has some unintended consequences. And I just ask you to really give that some thought, slow down a little bit, because it seems from the residents' point of view that the cities just keep taking on more and more and more power and authority to regulate business, and I think it's a concern.
Mr. Conroy.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, Senator Ortman, members of the committee, I have responsibilities as a county attorney to enforce the environmental laws under 115. I have responsibilities to enforce junkyards along state highways. The state has given me a lot of responsibilities of things I have to do. But then at the same time, I don't have the tools, as you referred to, a power tool. I don't have the power tool of the special assessment. Now, I go into court, get the injunction from a court, give it to the defendant, clean it up, do what you need to do. We'll work with you. And it doesn't happen. Then we go. There's all these layers. And even in 429, there's the layer of if the person goes through that public hearing process instead of going through court, if they go through that public hearing process and they don't like the result of that public hearing process, they can appeal to district court. That decision then goes to the district court to decide whether or not it's an appropriate use of that police power that we have. And in terms of junkyards, Werner Falk, we told him, you have 20 acres, you could make this into a junkyard. But he couldn't. He didn't do that. He didn't follow the requirements. It wasn't a guy just. It was a guy just throwing junk in his front yard. He thought it was scrap. He considered it a business, but he didn't follow the requirements in the land use ordinance to conduct that business, which he was entitled to.
Mr. Chair, and
Senator Ortman,
with all due respect, you have the order of a court to enforce, and you can go back to the court and seek further relief in the enforcement of the court's intention.
Mr. Conrad?
Senator Ortman, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, that's what we're trying to do. We can't go to the court right now and get a special and assess the property with that judgment. We can only put a lien on it. We're just asking the ability to do the special assessment.
Oh.
Senator Ortman.
We may disagree on that. I think the lien is sufficient. I don't think you need additional authority. I mean, we just disagree.
Any other questions, members? Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Conroy. Chair lays over Senate File 1102 for possible inclusion. And Senator Bach, you have got Senate File 520.
Mr. Chairman, Senate File 520 is a bill that came to me from the League of Cities. Cities are very, very concerned about the state's commitment to follow through on state aid payments that they receive, and you know they set their levy based on appropriations that we make, and when the state doesn't follow through and then they don't receive the aid that they've been promised, it creates a serious problem for cities. They don't have the opportunity to increase their levy. It's too late. It's set. The property tax statements are out. It happened in December when aid to cities and counties was unallotted. And what this bill would do is it would provide them an opportunity to issue a debt certificate in the event that the state aid was cut. That would have to be paid back over a two-year period. So they could order a short-term debt certificate to be able to bridge that budget problem, and then the next year they could turn around the levy to pay off the debt instrument. So this would just give cities some flexibility in the event that, you know, things that none of us intended when we appropriated money in the tax bill for aids out to cities and counties, give them a little flexibility in case, for some unknown reason, the aid doesn't come through the way we had planned on it. And Mr. Carlson may want to speak to it more.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. This language, I thank Senator Bach for offering this bill, first of all, but this language is not entirely new in state statute. If you look in Minnesota statutes 412.751, a similar authority already exists for what are called statutory Plan B cities to issue emergency certificates for extenuating circumstances. This was an idea that was hatched after the unallotment of the December aid payments, and knowing that the state was facing a very severe budget crisis, we were anticipating that we might have additional cuts in this coming July and December's aid payments, and we wanted to have a stopgap that would allow cities some flexibility to address the unanticipated loss of state aids. And based on the Chapter 412.751 reference, we decided to try to extend this to all cities. It is, again, optional for a city to use this. It's not mandatory. It gives them some flexibility. It is fairly limited. You have to basically determine that your receipts are less than expected and that the loss of revenue would make it impossible for you to meet your budgetary commitments. I should say that the bill also extends to things other than aid cuts. It would also, as drafted, extend to loss of property tax revenues that could result from an appeal of a property valuation. We've seen that happen in a couple of cities in the last couple of years where a property valuation has been reduced and the city's had to reimburse the property owner for that loss of revenue. Mr. Chair and members, the League supports this bill. We thank Senator Bach for introducing it, and I will stand for any questions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Carlson. Senator Armin.
Chair and Senator Bach, I understand what you're doing. You're trying to assist the cities, give them some answers. You know, what do they do? But I think we had this conversation when we talked about the levy limits. And I supported a repeal of the levy limits for this very reason, so that the cities could then raise property taxes with no limit to address whatever needs they had, whether it was because of a property tax revenue issue or whether it was because we cut LGA. But I think we are traveling down a very perilous road when we allow these cities to go into debt on an emergency basis without requiring at the same point some plan to get out of debt, some plan to correct their operational debt. The concern I have is we have all kinds of cities in California that are in bankruptcy. What's to stop any of our cities? And I know we've got great elected officials. I think you know I've said that over and over again. I know they are committed to their cities, just as we are committed to serve the state. But I worry about those cities that then don't see how perilous this is. And getting into debt is a really big problem for us on a local government level, a national government level. And I'm not sure we will see the end of this. I'm not sure that the cities will be, given the political pressures, be able to forecast and plan for the long-term arc here and then correct their operational deficiencies. We can see that in the Met Council right now. I see where it's heading, and I'm very concerned about it. So I'm not sure this is a tool, and maybe it's a lure into some bigger issues that I'm not sure Minnesotans really want their cities to be engaged in those discussions. I think this is I'm concerned about this. Maybe you can answer that, Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, we're facing a very difficult conclusion to this session because the federal stimulus bill prohibits us from having a budget reserve if we accept the federal money. We're all going to accept the federal money, but we're prohibited from having a budget reserve as a part of that, taking that federal money. So somehow here, when we close this session up and go home, we're going to go home without a budget reserve. And I think cities are very, very nervous about that. They don't know. I mean, if you know, the last time we had a relatively deep recession in 81, 82, and there's some members are still here, there was a half a dozen special sessions because the economy kept getting worse, and Governor Quay kept calling people back, and they'd fix the problem. And a month later, they'd get called back again because revenue went south further. And I think there's people very concerned that Governor Plenty might not have the same attitude that Governor Quy had and might not have the willingness to call the legislature back to address what are almost certain going to be budgetary shortfalls in the rest of after we adjourn in May. And, I mean, if December is any reflection on where the governor would go maybe for cuts is... their July payments in current LGA could be impacted. Forget about December. And we have to make sure that cities have some vehicle. I mean, not all cities have adequate reserves. Some cities are going to have adequate reserves to build the bridge. But those that don't, I think we have if we're going to have a good state-local fiscal relationship, we need to at least give them the tools to manage their budget when we don't follow through and deliver them the aid that they anticipated and set their budget based on. And Senator Orman, it is a two-year instrument, simply until they get an opportunity to levy to pay it back.
Senator.
But we're in pretty uncharted territory, Mr. Chairman, because we're not going to be able to have a budget reserve.
And Senator Bach, as you pointed out, it is 2 years. They're not borrowing for 20 years for today's expenses. They're trying to deal with some short-term cash flow on a very short-term basis. But Senator Artman.
Well, Mr. Chair, to the extent that there are reserves, I'm hoping, Senator Bach, that you would require the cities to use reserves before they resort to these types of loans and borrowing. I think at least that would give us some protection that they aren't setting themselves up to fail. I think... Couldn't we put something in there that says exhaust your reserves first? And if you've exhausted your reserves, you've looked at a property tax levy, hopefully we won't have any limits, then and only then might you engage in this type of short-term lending or borrowing.
Mr. Chairman, we'll have a discussion about what is some kind of a acceptable level of reserve. I think that's a reasonable position, I think. But I don't, I mean, the local officials I know are not going to go out and borrow money if they have adequate reserves. But if we need, Senator Orman, if you feel like we need to put some protection in there. I mean, I don't want them to take reserves down to zero, but there is some acceptable level, I think, that they can come down to, and maybe the league knows what that might be. But
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Orman, it's not without cost that you issue issue debt, and I think the cities are going to be, well, and this applies to counties, let me say, as well, but I don't think that a city council is necessarily going to go out and issue a certificate unless it's absolutely necessary. I truthfully hope that this is not a tool that has to be used very often or frequently, but again, once you adjourn here and once we see the implications of the budget cuts that are going to affect cities, we acknowledge that will occur. And not knowing what's going to happen with the forecast next November and whether there will be another unallotment, we were just trying to create a little bit of a safety valve here. But I think the real goal is again, just to provide some safety net. I'm sorry.
Mr. Barnhart.
My name is Bill Barnhart. I'm talking on behalf of North Metro Mayors. Number one, thank you for putting this forth. It is a tool within a context that nobody is in favor of unreasonable reserves. I would point out that cities are in a unique bind vis-a-vis their reserves because of the timing of payments. And in particular, for most, when property tax payments comes in and when the state aid payments are made, and in particular, by the end of April, most cities are at a very low point and must have a reserve established on January 1st, or they will not make it through that April payment. So the timing of tax, creates a need for reserves, that it's not a matter of exhaust your reserves if the December payments are unallotted. A two-year tool here is needed to bridge the gap.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Bach,
but would you be more comfortable maybe if we put a sunset on this and maybe this instrument was only available for a couple of years, maybe limit it maybe to these pretty extraordinary recession that we have?
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, yes, and I still think there should be some examination of the reserves, some trigger there, because what you're saying is the cities need the flexibility in their cash flow. I don't disagree, but I also don't want them to create operational problems for themselves with sustainability, and I don't want them funding operations if they don't have to out of short-term loans. And so that's what I'm trying to get at. Let's put some protections in there to make sure that the cities see that this is not a way to address their operational shortfalls, but a way to address their cash flow issues.
Senator Sengem.
Mr. Chair, as many of us maybe have served in local, I don't think cities are going to go into this easy, but and it would be reluctant. It'd be a difficult decision. But I'm trying to understand what a certificate of debt of indebtedness really is. They're sold apparently, and who buys them? In other words, in the end, who takes the risk if a city wouldn't pay it back? And I'm sure they do. But
Mr. Carlson,
who takes the risk on these?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sengem, cities could go to a bank and probably take out get the money from a bank loan basically to do this.
Okay.
It doesn't have to be an extraordinary issuance of a debt. But, really the idea is, again, is to have a stopgap here for a city that really has an unforeseen problem. They can't meet their budgetary expenses because of the loss of revenue.
So, Mr. Chair, it's simply a loan, and the lending institution will decide on rates and assess risk and take that chance. Okay.
Any other question, members? Anybody else who would like to speak with regard to Senate File 520? Thank you. Thank you, Senator Bach. Chair lays over Senate File 520 for possible inclusion. And, members, I've got a couple, three bills. I think they're relatively small in detail, so maybe I'll just do them from right here. On the first bill, Senate File 1258, Mr. Daling from Anoka County is here. This is a bill that deals with mortgage registry tax payment. I'll just let Mr. Daling explain it. Mr. Daling, welcome to the committee.
Good morning. My name is Larry Deline. I'm the Director of Property Records for Anoka County. I'm here on behalf of MACO, the Minnesota Association of County Officers. Currently, they're on a mortgage that's over $1 million that gets recorded in several counties. The tax is paid in the first county that it's recorded in, and then it's the responsibility of the first county to contact all the other counties to find out the values, to prorate the 3% of the mortgage registration tax that the county keeps, and then forward the payments to the various counties. I have a couple of examples of what this means. My staff found me a couple of good examples before I left today. One of them was a $13 million mortgage that got recorded in 12 counties. And the mortgage registration tax was, the county portion was $892. So the amount that got distributed varied from $6 to $100, and it meant contacting the 13 counties with all of the legal descriptions, getting the values, and then prorating the tax, the 3%. Now, it is a lot of work for not much gain, because this was kind of a larger mortgage that we were dealing with here. On a $1 million mortgage, or one that's slightly over $1 million, we're only dealing with $69. And the administrative cost of contacting all the other counties to divvy up that small portion of money is really not cost effective anymore. I think if I could give you just a little bit of history, prior to 1987, all of the mortgage registration tax stayed with the county. 97% of it was meant to offset the social services budgets in the counties, and 3% went into the county general fund to kind of offset the collection process of the tax. And then in 1987, there was legislation passed which directed the counties to forward the 97% directly to the state general fund for their disbursement, and the counties still retained the 3%, and it's my understanding that was to continue to administer the collection and disbursement of the tax to the state. And at that point in time, they did raise the minimum sharing to the $1 million mortgages. However, that's still maybe back then it was cost-effective to do that, but in today's environment it really isn't. And most mortgages that we deal with at our multi-county aren't really for all that much money. You know, $10 million is a large mortgage that we end up having to deal with, and that's probably the exception rather than the rule. We don't get many of these a year, maybe a dozen. And a few years ago, people didn't pay much attention to this because there was such a huge volume of mortgages that counties really didn't track this very well. And I think that I'm coming to you today because I've seen counties paying more attention to this of late, and it's gotten to be more of a headache for all of us, because some of us still really don't track it very closely and worry about it, and some counties do. And I've been contacted by some counties, you know, well, gee, you need to send me my portion, and after I calculate it, it's $10, and it's hardly worth cutting a check to send another county $10.
Thank you.
So I'm here to answer any questions, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here today.
And Mr. Daly, give us an example of the types of properties that we would be dealing with.
Well, these would be, I think the one that the staff gave me was a developer that had property scattered throughout Minnesota and was restructuring their debt is what I think was going on there. There are some commercial properties where this would apply, where they have multiple properties in various different counties, and they may refinance their situations, and so then they end up having to file the documents in various counties. And the general practice is to pay the mortgage registration tax in the first county that they record in.
And Mr. Daly, is there a thought of raising the $1 million to some higher number so that we don't?
That would be kind of our fallback position, but I think the counties that I talked to, at least in the metro area, are all in favor of just eliminating the necessity of doing it at all. But if the Senate feels that they're, you know, still has some value in doing it, if you raised it to $50 million or $20 million, would certainly be helpful. But we'd appreciate just getting rid of it altogether.
Questions, members? Senator Artman.
Mr. Chair, the budgets for these counties are also this type of revenue is not really making that big a difference. I think it makes perfect sense to do what's recommended.
Yeah. Anyone else who would like to speak with regard to Senate File 1258? Seeing none, chair lays over Senate File 1258 for possible inclusion. Thank you.
Thank you.
And members, I've got a cleanup bill with regard to the bovine TB credit that we did last year, and I think Mr. Nord is here from the department to talk about it. But if you remember, we offered a property tax credit to landowners that were in the area that had their continued testing requirements placed upon them by the split state status that we did. There were some issues with that credit, and so we're making sure that the credit is going where we intended it to. Mr. Nord.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill addresses a few of the administrative problems that we had with the original bovine TB credit. The first thing it addresses is a size and scope problem where we had some parcel. There was actually one parcel that was 2,100 acres that had a herd of 30 cows, and then under the old language, it was difficult to ascertain whether that entire 2,100 acres should have no credit for its taxes for only 30 cows, or you could have 400 or 500 acres but only a couple of cows, and so there was a scaling issue. This bill addresses that by identifying a credit that is equal to $5 per animal for the number of whole herd test count that was performed during the last 3 years, 2006, 7, and 8. So that provides a greater degree of relationship to the credit and the number of cattle that the landowner had. And the rationale for that calculation is $5 is roughly about the amount of property taxes per acre, and 5 acres is roughly the number of acres you need to support a cow or these animals. And so it provides better scaling than the older language. It also addresses the issue of the change from Class 2A, the old Class 2A to the new Class 2A and 2B rural vacant land. Without this change, the rural vacant land wouldn't have been included in the credit. It would have only applied to the new 2A agricultural land. So we've addressed that as well. And we've also addressed the fact that there were some animals that were tested in 2006 that were kind of drawn out by the old language. And we're clarifying that it applies to cattle, bison, goats, and farmed cervidae. So a number of technical issues we're trying to get a better handle on with this version of the credit.
And Mr. Nord, have the assessors in these four affected counties reviewed this, and they all think it'll work for them?
Yes. We had I don't know that they've specifically reviewed the language, but we've had conversations that led to this language, and they certainly appreciate the clarification.
Thank you. Senator Ortman?
Mr. Chair, I'm really not all that citified, but what's farmed cervidae?
Elk or deer.
Is there some reason why it doesn't deer. Just say that?
Yes.
Deer or elk? Why do we call it something else?
Well, Senator Ortman, I don't exactly know, but it has to do with the type of hoof that the animal has, and I think they have to have a split hoof. I'm not an expert in this area either, but I think it's domesticated or raised, farm-raised elk or deer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions, members? Thank you, Mr. Nord. Chair lays over Senate File 1530 for possible inclusion. And members, Senate File 1350, I don't have any testifiers, but Mr. Hasty has been working on an issue. And there's a question about whether this should have just been done in the full committee or not, because while it affects a property, it is a income tax issue. And so I think maybe we'll have Mr. Hasty walk through the bill, and we will make sure that we get this up into the full committee, but I think we'll have to have a more detailed discussion in the full committee because it's an income estate tax issue as opposed to a property tax issue, but it deals with property. So if you could just give us a quick run through, please.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. Senate File 1350 actually touches on two issues. The first, Section 1, deals with a non-resident individual who's subject to Minnesota income tax to the extent that they're taxed under the Internal Revenue Code in their capacity as a sole member of a limited liability company. And this is with respect to their income that would otherwise be allocable to the state. And so under this section, they would be taxed as though that individual had actually directly realized the income from the source rather than through the limited liability company. And the paragraph makes that change to that section there. Section 2 also makes a change which is similar to Section 1. And in paragraph C, it generally provides for the assignment of income or gains from intangible personal property that's not otherwise employed in a trade or a business if the recipient is a resident of Minnesota. And the new sentence specifically provides that a gain from the sale of an interest in a single member limited liability company would be allocated to Minnesota as if the limited liability company did not exist. And Section 3 is to do with the estate tax nexus. And this, again, these are all for non-resident individuals, and this would be for non-resident decedents, and expands the definition of the situs for non-resident decedents. And so if they are a non-resident of Minnesota and if they had an interest in a pass-through entity that had real or tangible Minnesota property, then the situs of that property is determined as if the pass-through entity did not exist and the property was personally owned by the decedent. And so, and this includes, those entities include those taxed as S-corporations, partnerships, trusts, and single-member limited liability companies. And so, you know, these are all for non-resident individuals. It affects the estate tax and the income tax as well.
And members, the way I understand this issue, there are a number of landowners that have been forming LLCs in order to avoid paying state taxes or in Minnesota when there's a death. And so this is an effort to get at that and to make sure that those taxes are collected. Is that correct, Mr. Hastings?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members. And I think that this language was worked on both with the department and with House Research in terms of coming up with some standard uniform set of what kind of entities are we going to take a look at here. And what was happening was that non-residents who had, say, owned a property, a cabin or another home in Minnesota were then forming these single-member limited liability companies and using that as a way to pass on property to other family members without getting nexus and then paying taxes. And so this kind of closes that almost loophole to make sure that they do pay taxes that they should be paying.
Questions? Senator Hartman.
Mr. Chair, I think I understand. If I'm a Wisconsin resident, but I own property in Minnesota, I might have formed a limited liability company, said that the income from that property was income to the limited liability company. I take it in Wisconsin and get taxed Wisconsin income tax, not Minnesota income tax, even though the income was generated in Minnesota. Is that what you're getting at?
Mr. Chair, Senator Artman, yes, it's similar to what we're getting at. I mean, the issue is the, especially for decedents, I mean, they really, if they didn't form these limited liability companies, then what should be happening is that they would then the income would be part of their estate tax, part of that calculation. But by forming a single member limited liability company here, yes, they're not paying estate tax on the value of that property in Minnesota, which they otherwise would be. And so this makes clear that whether you form this kind of entity or a similar kind, they would have, you know, pass through taxation that would otherwise avoid the estate tax nexus. That we would treat this as if they personally owned the property, and we wouldn't recognize the limited liability concept in these very specific situations.
Senator Armin.
Is it limited then to the estate for estate tax purposes? Because it could have broader application that I'm kind of concerned about.
Mr. Hastings.
Mr. Chair, Senator Armin, it's limited mainly to estate tax, but as you see in Section 1 and Section 2, this does also cover income tax situations where, also non-resident individuals who otherwise would be paying income tax on certain kinds of property. And, again, these companies limited liability companies, single member of companies are being formed purely, it seems purely for the purpose of avoiding paying income taxes in those situations. And so this then adds paragraphs to make sure that we do establish nexus for these, for this income tax that should be paid.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Armin.
It's because we're so technical, I hope you don't mind another question about this. With respect to the pass-through, does the Department of Revenue then have to establish that it was set up as a limited liability company solely for the purpose of avoiding the tax?
Mr. Hastie.
Mr. Chair, Senator Armin, no, they did not have to establish that it was for the purpose of avoiding the tax. I mean, they just have to establish, I mean, this establishes if they set up a single member limited liability company in this situation, then no matter what the, you know, we're not looking at the intent or the purpose behind this. Is if this is done, nexus will now be established, especially for estate tax purposes.
Senator Armin.
Mr. Chair, I just wonder about the disincentive we're creating then for the investment in Minnesota. Now, maybe what you're saying is they're not paying taxes and yet they are benefiting from, you know, the property ownership here in the state of Minnesota. But I wonder, are we then, do we have so many of these folks that we're then inhibiting further investment in this way? Is there some impact in that sense? And do you know how many are currently slipping through the cracks here without paying tax?
Well, Senator Ortman, I think what started this was cabins were being passed on through these mechanisms and avoiding the estate tax. That's where this discussion started from. But Mr. Hastie.
But Mr. Chair, that was my question, was where we were just talking about estate taxes. I think I understand that part. It's if there's a broader application, now I'm concerned about investment in the state of Minnesota.
Yeah, very good. Senator Ortman, Mr. Hastie, would you have additions there?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, in terms of investment in Minnesota, I'm not sure, how that would impact overall investment, for income tax purposes. I think that in terms of the revenue analysis that we received on this proposal, it was determined there would be very few taxpayers that this would implicate. There wasn't a number given of how many taxpayers this would, but certainly the second page of the revenue estimate does talk about some of the ratios in terms of how much income, the size of the estate that would be affected, and they were fairly large size estates. But in terms of the overall impact on investment, I wouldn't be able to answer that at this time.
And Senator Ortman, very, very good questions. And as I mentioned, this, while it's in division because, the cabins were property, it really is a full committee issue because it's income and estate taxes. So my intent is to move this to the full committee with the report. I requested it to be referred to the property tax division, what this is all about. And I want to get it back to the full committee, and we'll continue the discussion there. But I think you've raised some questions in my mind a little bit, too, that we need to answer. So is that okay with you, Senator Armin?
Mr. Chair, that's just fine. I think we might want to just restrict it to the estate tax for now, just so that we understand what the implications are, no unintended consequences. I do have a bill that will take on that recommendation from, I'm trying to remember which, I think it was the tax commission, the Blue Ribbon Panel on Tax Commission, to exempt 20% of our pass-through income with a cap on it. And so I'm really interested in this issue. I don't want to disincent somebody from investing or starting a business in Minnesota. So I think we can get at least part of it done, and we'll have a further discussion in the big committee.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Chair, I'll lay over Senate File 1350 for possible inclusion. I think that concludes the work today. The committee's adjourned.